So is the podcast, does it have a... are you looking for a specific focus in the podcast, or is it more just what people bring to it?
Yeah, well, we've been having this discussion a lot in the last couple of weeks about, you know, how much it's bubbling to the surface, but there was, you know, the original, I guess, thing we were trying to track was the Shire's response to the climate emergency, but I suppose within that, it's probably less about the projects and the actions and the things that happen. It's more about how people are coming to terms with that idea in their own way or not. It's a confronting thing to look down the barrel of, I suppose, so you know, uncover the emotional side of it too, and for a lot of people that's what turns them on or off.
Hello and welcome to Artbreaker, the show about creativity, the climate crisis, and the art we make, both about and in response to the climate crisis. You're listening to the first episode of Season 2 of Artbreaker, a show now no longer just a hobby, but a proper member of the Climactic Collective, the podcast network by and for Australia's climate community. My name is Mark Spencer, and I'm the co-founder and publisher of the Climactic Collective. And Artbreaker is one of my passion projects. So I am so grateful that you've joined me today for the first episode in this new season. You've got some amazing stuff coming up to look forward to. And it's the work of a whole bunch of amazing people who'll be introducing themselves in due course. The goal for this series is to help show us that there's no one way to engage with climate and respond to the climate crisis, and that creativity and the creatives within our society are responding, and doing so in myriad and beautiful ways. We'll be talking to all manner of creatives across every artistic discipline, but I think it's only right that we're starting now with two podcasters. Although I think it's a sign of maturity of the podcast ecosystem that Endgame, the project they work on together, can be called a podcast. Because it's more beautiful than almost anything else that calls itself a podcast. You're going to hear all about it from Kyla and Rob right now. So, thanks again for listening, and welcome to Season 2 of Artbreaker.
Well, I'd like to say thank you to the Jajawarong people on whose lands I'm living and playing and sleeping and making and bringing up my kids. Beautiful country here, and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging.
I'm also on the lands of Jajawarong and very grateful that I'm starting to meet and get to know some of the elders and First Nations people in this area where we live, and as a result start to open up a whole new way of seeing this landscape that we are lucky to inherit. My name's Rob Law. I live in central Victoria with my two children, Ralph and Otto, who are 6 and 3, and my wife Moya. And we back on to Campbell's Creek, which is a beautiful creek now that's been regenerated over time by the Friends of Campbell's Creek. This 30 or 40 years ago just wasn't here. It was just a completely denuded landscape since the gold rush in the 1850s, where every tree in sight was ripped up and it was all of the ground was unearthed. Except being down here right now, you'd never know that because it's incredibly diverse. This has come about through a few committed local people that have spent, you know, the last 2 decades revegetating this creek. And now there's stands of yellow gums and yellow boxes with the silver and black wattles, and then more and more understory gradually appearing. And occasionally, I don't think it'll be tonight, but occasionally I see a platypus down here in this creek, as well as a long-necked turtle. And I co-produce Endgame.
Well, my name's Kyla Brettle, and I live on the opposite side of Castlemaine to Rob Law. I live in Barkers Creek, in a little stone cottage here with my partner Brian and my two kids Arlo and Fionn, and my cat here, the lovely Midnight.
How do you describe Endgame, like, to your friends? So picture yourself at like a family barbecue or like a community event, and someone says, "Hey, I hear you do this Endgame thing. What is it?" And you can't assume they're an audio listener or familiar with podcasts or any of the crazy stuff you do or the background in music production or Radio National.
I tried to do this last night because we had friends over for dinner and I struggled so badly. And in the end, Moya had to step in and explain it, which is, so I'm really keen to hear Kyla have a go at it first.
I was hoping you would go first. This is where I really need you to be on the image so I can look at you and give you that little desperate look and say, Rob, save me here. Can you go first? Well, you sure you don't want to go first?
Do you want me to go first? So Endgame is a sound project that Kyla and I are working on for the past 6 to 8 months. And it's trying to really take a local look at climate change, but with a much more of a personal focus on bringing out the stories that people are experiencing about climate change in this place where we live, and trying to tell the story in a slightly different way, I suppose, from just about facts and figures or about solutions to climate change, and sort of get into the more emotional, more personal experiences of climate change as it's taking place now and what it means for all of us.
And I think also one of the things about the show is that we're kind of working at this intersection between story and music and sound, and we're trying to use kind of all the emotional tools in the palette of sound making to try and explore these deeper levels to climate change and how it affects us.
Can you speak to those sort of tools in your toolkit? What's your toolkit you're playing with, and where did that come from?
The canvas within sound and radio and podcasting is just wonderful because it's frameless. And with radio, you get to put the listener within a three-dimensional space, if you like, which is incredible personal space to start off with. Because if you think about cinema and television, the screen's always on the opposite side of you. It's always on the outside of you. But with sound, it's like right inside you. So I think that's kind of one of the first place I think of the tools in the toolkit. You've also got so many different amazing and wonderful sound textures, just from the sound of archival to field recordings. And we hear so much detail in sound that we don't really think about so much. You hear distance, you hear space, you hear someone's relationship within sound. You know when someone doesn't like the person that they're talking to, and all these things are revealed on the edges of sound. It's a beautiful, wonderful and powerful medium to work within.
The thing that I'm discovering mainly through working with Kyla, who has, you know, amazing radio making skills compared to me, who I'm quite new to creating radio, I suppose, is just how you really can create scenes and create this sense of moving between the first person, so being quite, you know, intimate with someone that you're interviewing, but then sort of crossing to some other scene and taking someone on a journey in a very sort of short space of time. And I think in other mediums, that's a bit of a challenge, but I think it's really exciting with sound how you can do that in real subtle ways, so much so that the listener isn't quite aware perhaps of the experience that they're having, but it's just happening through the skills of the way that the sound's been crafted.
One of the things I really like is it's almost like radio, sound work, podcast, whatever you want to call it, has a foot in the camp of music and how music makes sense to us through repetition and variation and texture and tonal range and the intensity and density of a sound. Like, we feel the ebb and flow musically and we read those musical cues, but it also really works in a similar way to story and filmmaking in terms of creating a scene and moving on, you know, the way that a story progresses. And that's also one of the wonderful things about working with Rob as a composer. His music is such beautiful phrasing, and the way he can shift a piece of music and feel the melding into something else, and how it can kind of play in a sort of a counterpoint with the other elements of the piece, like the field recordings or the interview or what have you. That it's kind of that intersection and interplay between those two voices, which I think is really exciting. I was a filmmaker before I turned to radio. I first studied music, actually, and Rob and I went to the same music school years apart. And then I went on to do filmmaking, and then I came to radio from there. So I'm always wanting to know where we are in a scene, in a location, in a room, what people are doing, where they are in relation to one another. And that really helps you construct the sounds. I guess I'm trying to get that visceral 3D sort of feel of where someone is in a piece. So I think I probably bring visuals and place out of my making of radio.
I suppose realizing as I'm learning more about making this kind of sound work with Kyla, how there are sort of things that I am bringing across from music in the approach to sound, like with, you know, a lot of my music is very textural and layered as well. And it sort of obviously has to, as music does, sort of have a sense of the arc and what it's building towards or what it's shifting into. So I think just it's quite interesting to me just to see how those things sort of cross over. Kyla has built many wonderful dry stone walls, as people can do in central Victoria, and I think you've described radio making a little bit like that sometimes in the editing suite. It can be a little bit about picking the right stone for the right place.
Yeah, it's a big pile of stuff, and you know that there's a story in there. You just have to dig around and find it. I think it's that combination of finding things that sit really nicely together and also finding those moments that sing to you, that just leap out and you go, that moves me, that touches me, that tells me something about the world or this person or myself. And you always go for those bits.
What shifts you from being intellectually aware of something and then it going deeper? I work in communications. I would love it if I could manipulate that moment. But I actually don't think you can. I think it's really a personal moment that can't be manipulated. I won't go into the horrors of what I've had to read, but as one of the climate scientists I've worked with closely has said, I wish I didn't know what I know. But she does know, as do I. There's the intellectual, kind of conceptual, abstract idea, and then there's this head crack, the gut-wrenching, emotional moment. And once you've had that moment, there's no turning back, because you get it, you feel it in your guts, and it's terrifying. And as a mother, and you just want to protect your child, and this is all mother of threats to your child. This is something you can't just stand out, let it go. You've got to rise up and do something.
The collaboration between Kyla and myself has very much come out of the climate emergency. That, you know, how we sort of met, I suppose, was through our local shire having this debate about whether or not to declare a climate emergency. And through that, I suppose, we connected, and then we started to talk about this idea of making this sound project together. So I think, you know, yes, we may have individually gone on and done our own thing, but whether or not it's sort of in this format and together, it's all due to the fact that we have this shared interest and shared concern about climate change.
I've been making radio for a good 20 years now, and I really thought I'd had my dash. I'd done what I'd come to do, and I was out of there about 5 years ago when my daughter was born. Luckily, she was born just after my, you know, last show for ABC Radio National. Yeah, I was prepared to throw it away, and then the climate crisis really hit me, and I'm feeling like I really need to do something about this. And I sort of fumbled around trying to do some things, and that sort of led me to Rob, and he suggested doing a radio show, and I was thinking, no, I couldn't go back there, but these are the skills that I have, and this is the best way I think I can use them, you know, for good, if you like. It's really exciting working outside the system. And when you're working in a radio show or for an institution, there are so many stipulations on what you have to do and how you have to go about it and how long it is and what your time is worth and what it's all about and what the audience thinks. And it's really exciting working on this podcast project outside of Radio National, because it's like, there's nothing holding us back. We've got this opportunity to explore things in a way that you can't working for a large institution. And we're really wanting our work to be as spreadable as possible rather than sticky, I guess.
You're making a festival film, and then it's like getting run in other festivals. You're not having to be the one to go out and promote it and have a release and everything, and kind of you want people to enjoy the content and you know, get something from it rather than really maybe feel a connection with you guys as the creators. It's more about the stuff you're making.
I think we've talked a lot about audience and, you know, what we're trying to do. Are we trying to connect to very much to our local community and our local audience? That was probably how we started off.
with the view that perhaps down the track we would broaden that out. But I think we've kind of flipped that around a little bit in the sense that we're creating these shows that, in a sense, are one-off pieces in a way that could be attractive to certain networks of people, and we're really trying to farm that out to those audiences where they exist rather than sort of, you know, rely on someone coming across our website or our podcast and that one day, you know, we'll become, you know, really famous and everyone will know about it and listen to it. So we're really trying to sort of find the hooks into different sorts of audiences that are already there and use what we're making in that way to be a bit more flexible in how we approach our audiences.
I agree entirely.
A beautiful sound, isn't it? It's a raven, isn't it?
Mm,
I
think yeah.
I first became really aware of it a few years ago in the Flinders Range. It's just so, if you get up in the morning, you just hear that sound, that dying.
Yeah, they're beautiful, isn't it? Agitation and then, oh, shit, yeah. It's useless.
Oh, shit. Take it easy, mate.
Thank you.
Like the Raven's song, optimism and energy in the climate movement rises and falls. Here in Castlemaine, in central Victoria, we're a small town with a big history of climate and environmental action, and there's a lot of support for the movement within the wider community. But moving forward hasn't been easy or without failure. One project that struggled to get over the line for a long time was the campaign to get our council to declare a climate emergency. Heather Cummins was a member of the most recent group to give it a go by collecting signatures on a petition for council. This was back in December 2019, before the pandemic hit, when it felt like there was a lot of momentum around climate action. Heather describes what it was like, sitting in council chambers, listening to the debate and hoping a climate emergency would finally be declared.
I think there was a lot of apprehension about which way council would vote and what we were walking into.
So we're creating a show that's, you know, it's very hyper-local in the sense that we're really constraining ourselves to find characters where we live and not look, you know, beyond our own shire boundaries at this stage. And I think that constraint has sort of been nice in a way because it's made us dig deeper, I suppose, into different ways of thinking about climate change and the topic that we're looking at from many different angles within where we live. But it's also, you know, this is climate change. We're in a climate emergency. What everyone's experiencing and facing here is universal. And I think that's what we're really trying to make sure, that what we're creating is universal to all audiences, ideally, and that people find their own ways of connecting into the characters that we're talking about. So yes, it's hyperlocal, but that sort of dissolves into the background after a while. It's sort of less important where these people are from. It's just that idea that we're telling stories differently, I suppose, but in a way that people, you know, from Canada or people from Northern Australia can still identify with this person that's talking from their block of land out in the outskirts of Castlemaine.
I think there's something a little bit ironic about that idea of, for something to be really universal, it also needs to be very detailed and very specific in order to make that connection. You remember those unique details about something, and it's almost the little details that help you connect with someone on the other side of the screen, on the other side of the world. And those little elements of the stories, in some ways, look, it's that narrow focus, deep view type of idea of looking at a story and how a small space can be a microcosm for the larger problems that we face.
Very well said.
We have started to hear from people that they have this experience in their life that is really shifting for them, where they've gone from, you know, understanding climate change, being concerned about it, but it's sort of still an intellectual, abstract kind of thing. And I think there is a shift that people experience. It can be in a moment, or it can sort of creep up, I suppose, and that can shift into a very emotional, personal state. And that's the kind of moment that we're really trying to sort of draw out from people, is trying to understand their experiences of that. So we did put a call out to people, and as part of our sort of way of, you know, seeing different ways that we might have impact with our show, to try to draw out some of these stories from people as they listen to some of our pieces about describing their own head crack moment.
Hi, my name's Kyla Brettle, and I work on a show called Endgame Podcast.
Am I crazy?
No, I don't think I am. I don't think other people are either. I think it's just very...
I'm wanting to ask you if you or anyone else you know has undergone one of those definable moments when they've shifted from having an intellectual understanding of climate change...
Kind of conceptual abstract idea.
...to really connecting with the issue emotionally, like on a gut level, like a
head crack.
I really understand what climate change means.
It completely undermines our reality, and it's terrifying.
If this is you or anyone you know, please come to our website and share your story and help us make something really beautiful out of this. Endgamepodcast.net. Hope to see you there. And I had a head-cracking moment quite severely, I felt, that there was one moment I was off and then the next day I was on and something humongous happened in between, and it wasn't just sort of crying on the kitchen floor at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's like you ever been camping and you're in the tent and it's been raining and raining and raining and there's a huge kind of dram of water getting lower and lower on the tent roof, and if you just touch the ceiling, it'll all start streaming down. I just found it really, really difficult to get my head around climate change, and I didn't want to deal with it, and thinking about it and talking about it kind of made me feel sick and hopeless and powerless. And then it was something about the koalas for me. There was something about the koalas going extinct that cut through everything else that had been unable to reach me for whatever reason, and things shifted and turned, and it was, yeah, that it was over the next couple of days I really came to that decision, and that decision with my partner, that we really had to do something, do as much as we could about this situation. And I was looking for that story, and that was a story that I shared with Mel on a bit of a road trip up north, and we just sort of met. So it was really great, you know, you jump in a car with a new friend and talk about, you know, love and life and climate change and what makes you tick, and you have those sort of really intense long conversations. And so we talked about all of this stuff, and once I started opening up that story, looking around me, it's like all these people are going off like popcorn, you know, having these head-cracking moments, and it feels like, well, there's something in this. And so I felt quite personal about really needing to tell that story, because in lots of ways it was my own story as well.
Audio has primarily been about music, and music had a very troubled relationship with it in a way. Like, I suppose for many, many years I kind of had this love-hate relationship with it, I think partly because I was studying it and it was very institutionalized, you know, being taught music, and there's all these hang-ups that you develop that Kyla can shares with me perhaps about going through an institution like the Victorian College of the Arts, where you really have to do your time. And I think it took a really long time for me to sort of break that down and get back to really understanding how music is really important for me to process things that are happening on that level that you just can't access, I suppose, through talking or through any other means. Because I also have worked on climate change for many, many years, I think increasingly music for me became about processing all of this climate change grief and, you know, everything that you experience around thinking about the future and where we are at. So that's it for me, I think.
My first association with audio was through music, and it was studying music. And I studied music because my brother was an artist and my mum was writing, and it sort of wasn't really that much left. It was like one of the few unclaimed territories in my family, and it sort of swept me away. But I think music has probably become, it's really the cornerstone of how I understand the world, I think. It's like we say, audio, but it's not just about your ears, it's about your heart, it's about your mind, it's about your emotions, it's about a way of seeing and perceiving and understanding the world, I think. And this idea of listening, and listening in for what you know, and also listening out for what you don't know, is somehow really important just for being a human and for the way that we interact with the world. And so for me, audio, it's about listening as much as it is about expressing.
I used to live in Darwin in the Northern Territory, and I remember going into the museum there. They have this room that you go into in the darkness, and it has this sound work about Cyclone Tracy, so a recording of the cyclone that came through in 1975. It's amazing, like, you know, your hair stands on the back of your neck, and it was such a physical experience being in that room that kind of awoke me to how powerful it can be to give people those real experiences just through sound and shutting down all your other senses, yet you can kind of start creating all your other senses by what you're hearing alone. And, you know, luckily enough, to this day, I haven't been in a cyclone, but I can sort of, I feel like I've had that experience now myself. So that's the power of sound, I think.
I kind of avoided climate-engaged audio for quite some time. So what was... All I can think of is the sound of wind and rain and the floods that came around 2011, that driving rain and that sense when the sound went from being beautiful and benign to scary and terrifying, how it's easy for that sound to slide from one to the other in an almost seamless way. But it progresses in beats.
I feel like I want to keep talking about this, but I won't. That's right. Well, also when I was in my early 20s, I got given this book called Wild Sound by Bernie Krause, and it's about this pioneer of field recordings who goes out and has recorded all of these different ecosystems over time and has an accompanying CD. And I think this idea that, you know, these ecosystems have these disturbances and that it really shifts the sonic landscape in there as well. It just opened up a whole new way of thinking about nature and about everywhere that I've gone bushwalking and things like that. So all of a sudden, whenever I was out, you know, walking for an overnight hike or something, I started to listen a lot more to where I was and think about how these landscapes might change over time through sound, and, you know, they become less diverse because of changes and start to sound less, you know, sonically interesting, etc.
We were just talking the other day or last week about how you can actually hear a whole ecosystem in a way that you can't see it or touch it or experiencing it in other ways. The way that different creatures take up the sound space is so beautiful.
I experience that in my own family because I've got 5 sisters and 2 brothers, and somehow everyone manages to talk at the same time but all understand what the other one said.
One of the things I think that inspires me to act at the moment is that I feel we are in a moment in time and history when the story is at a turning point where you can still hear so much hope in so much of the media that we're making and that other people are making. There are a lot of people waking up at the moment, and I think there's a very tangible pain and anguish and love and hope and striving to the kind of material that we're hearing and making at this particular point in time. And maybe in the future, when things feel more established or more decided, perhaps. I don't know. So much of what I'm doing is for my kids, or at least so my kids can see that I'm trying as hard as I possibly can.
Before I started making Endgame with Kylo, I used to write to my kids, like, you know, in the future, I suppose, to keep a sort of a little book, and I'd every now and then write a little entry, and it would always be about climate change and just try to sort of give them a sense of what was happening here and now. Whether or not they would ever read back it is another thing. But I think that kind of subsided when Endgame started. I think it kind of naturally took its place. I think it is, in a way, a nice idea that it's creating that time capsule moment that my kids may, or anyone might, look back on in 20, 30 years, and hopefully the state of affairs may be, you know, quite different then. There might be obviously a sense of why didn't people act earlier, and perhaps this is a way to kind of show there was something going on, that was everyone was going through this struggle, and hopefully we've come out the other side and are either, you know, we haven't solved climate change, but we've you know, substantially acted a lot more than we currently are.
I don't know about you, Rob, but I don't feel that I'm creating an image of the world, like a romantic image of the world to hand on to my kids. I guess I'm trying to create an image of the world of us struggling and striving and dealing with things and facing things and hopefully feeling stronger and empowered by doing this.
In a way, I kind of hope that this end game is actually quite boring to my kids, because by then, you know, it might be such a, you know, everyone is totally talking about this all the time, or they've gone through everything, and so everything that we're showing and bringing to light now is probably less interesting by then. Having said that, I think there's, you know, looking back in time and being able to sort of really hear more human personal stories is really important, and just really nice that they could look back and see that there was this time when people were really trying to wrestle with these issues on a deeper level, and it wasn't just sort of looking back over old news cycles or, you know, scientific reports that came out in 1985 or, you know, 2020, but that there's actually all this human story behind that too.
Changes that need to happen are deep. They're deep and long. Their roots are entwined with our sense of who we are and our culture. I think it'll take many years to unearth the kind of problems that have precipitated climate change.
I think there's a pretty strong sense of responsibility when you're making a sound project like this about climate change, because you're taking the listener on a journey, and, you know, it's through some pretty raw, heavy stuff at times. You don't want to just leave people completely debilitated on the floor in tears. You want to, you know, bring that out in them if you can, but sort of give them something to kind of work with after that. So what we're trying to both brainstorm a bit more is how do we use the shows to kickstart something else that they can do. It's really tricky because it's sort of like what we're doing with the show, you know, is trying to engage with the heaviness of climate change, and so often the solutions that get put forward or what you get connected into seem very small or not commensurate with the size of the problem. So I think we're trying to stick with the themes that we're doing with the impact. So, you know, tell us about your head crack moment or some other way that they can work with what they've experienced through the show, rather than just saying, here's a link to some solar panels or that type of thing.
And climate change is a really intense subject. It's like sex and violence. You've got to treat it with respect. And if you want to take people on a journey and hopefully have them open up to the show and have the show be able to touch them, you have to treat them with care and love as well. You can get all these great effects by having stuff that's really scary and really confronting, but someone to listen to our work and feel enriched by it, and to feel hopeful, and to feel touched, and to feel connected with someone else, or that someone else out there feels like they do or have thought this in this similar way. It's not that youthful thing of just trying to shock and awe and inspire. It's trying to help and spread, you know, the care and the love, if that doesn't sound too corny.
Not at all. Beautiful.
For most of my life, I've liked to surround myself with different string instruments from around the world, and now I've got so many of them that they're taking up a whole room in my house, actually. But I haven't named them yet, so that's something, I suppose.
So Highly Strung was a bit of a confronting one to end up publishing, because I suppose it was an idea that I had whilst driving my kid to childcare, and I guess it's one of these examples where I have an idea and I really want to get it done, and then I'm finished with it and I don't want to listen to it again. But I sent it to Kyla and she sent me back feedback. I'm like, oh no, I have to rework it. But it was really, really valuable, I think. And having Kyla's kind of, you know, been able to shape that up into something that was a lot better than what it started off as. And it was just this left of center idea that, you know, I have these two lives, I suppose, where I'm working on climate change in a particular day job, but I'm also a musician and a composer, and how those two things might have linked together in more subtle ways. But I suppose it just came about, and it's slightly tenuous in its link to climate change, I guess, but it's kind of a little bit of a snapshot, I suppose, about myself and my experience in why I'm making the show. Would really love to be able to sort of do the same thing with Kyla, but it's a very confronting thing to stick a microphone in front of the people that are producing something. So we'll see.
I love this piece. I love Rob's musical voice and his actual voice. And we see the multiple Robs in the one piece. And I love the sense of flow between the different phrasing of the music and the voice. And I think it's really beautiful in that sense because you can really relate everything back to music in one way or another. The way that instruments work together, how we need to listen to one another, how music sort of fits into our body and is a part of our whole expression. Just such a beautiful idea about thinking how lives in one area flow into another, and to use those two voices to juxtapose each other in a duet was just lovely. And Rob put this together really quickly and he was like, oh, I've got this idea, I'm going to run off and produce this wonderful thing. So for the team, which was just fantastic.
And now for you in its entirety, Highly Strung, from the Endgame podcast project, co-produced by Kyla Bredel and Rob Law.
For most of my life, I've liked to surround myself with different string instruments from around the world, and now I've got so many of them that they're taking up a whole room in my house, actually. But I haven't named them yet, so that's something, I suppose. My name's Rob Law. I'm a musician and composer living in central Victoria, Australia. For the past 20 years, I've had two day jobs, really, one as a film composer and also another working on climate change. I think working on an issue like climate change, that starts to seep into your whole being, and kind of noticing, I suppose, when I come into my music room now, the music that I'm making is probably a way for me to process all of the emotions that are going along with facing up to, you know, being a human on the planet at this point in time. And so, you know, things can get pretty dark in here. Sometimes I imagine that when I die, they might all simultaneously play a chord of relief, something that releases them from their servitude over the years. So I was classically trained on guitar, so that can lead to a certain way of playing that's sort of hard to break free of, I suppose. And so when I pick up a different instrument that's in a totally different tuning, my mind has to sort of take a back seat, and all of a sudden I'm just playing the instrument without too much awareness of what chords or notes I'm playing, just kind of that feeling that you might get when you sort of travel and you kind of have that sense of where you're going, but nothing's really familiar. And a part of you kind of likes that feeling of being a bit lost, but you kind of, yeah, you rely a bit on your intuition. So most of the instruments I have around here, they're variants on a guitar. I like that idea that almost every culture that's ever existed on the planet has had some form of a guitar in its culture. And, you know, some of these were directly influenced by the Spanish guitar, like the cuatros here of South America. Whereas others were more ancient than that, like this oud. And the Turkish saz baglama. And these instruments kind of have all these rich stories in and of themselves, you know, that sort of talk about a period of time when cultures first started to interact with one another. And I love how they're almost like animals who long ago travelled across continents when the land masses were joined together, or maybe they were sort of stowaways on ships. And then over time they evolve and adapt to their local environment and become something pretty different to what they were originally. So I'm holding my charango, which is my favourite instrument probably of all of them, and its body and neck is all carved out of one piece of wood. But sadly, I can't play this one because it exploded one day in a heatwave. And actually, this is my fourth charango explosion. And by explosion, I mean that the bridge that holds the strings on the top comes off and rips the wood off the face of it. So it's all pretty dramatic. But yes, I've gone through four of them now. So these are highly strung instruments, and they don't cope well with wild fluctuations in weather, especially not heat. So in a way, it's a shame that my favourite instrument is the least hardy to withstand the conditions that I live here in central Victoria, and I guess let alone climate change. So I'm just restringing my Ron Rocco, which is kind of like
the melancholic cousin of the charango, I suppose. It's bigger and it has a deeper sound and more sentimental. Kind of makes you just want to stop what you're doing and let a mix of kind of sorrow and sentimentality wash over you. And I really love it, but whereas the charango, the smaller one of these, is really to fire you up, and it's hard to be kind of too sorrowful when you hear a charango playing. It's very happy and light. What I find really fascinating about tuning an instrument is how the strings want to find their own tuning, and you have to keep stretching and training them before they sit in a particular tuning and stay that way. For a while, I just sort of thought this was just, you know, the tension releasing of a string so that it sort of starts to detune as it loosens. But I realised that if a string had been tuned to a higher pitch and you wanted to detune it from, say, an E down to a D, then that string will actually want to return to the higher pitch and actually increase its tension. Also, each string starts to kind of respond to the other strings, and the whole body of the guitar actually, through repeated vibration, starts to settle into itself and become more and more relatable to all the other elements. So I'm holding the only guitar I've ever made, and probably the only one I ever will make, just because of how long it took me, a couple of years. But I first noticed when I first made a guitar, how it felt very stale and stiff, and over time it's really opened up more and more, and apparently that's what it is. All the wood finds a way to vibrate together, which is sort of, you know, a pretty beautiful idea, I think. I guess I kind of feel a bit like a string the older I get, where I find my comfort zone and equilibrium with kind of my place and people around me, and things come along and kind of force you to retune and settle into a new pattern. And I guess it's a bit like that with climate change. We're sort of now constantly getting retuned, and everything around us is too, like the plants and animals. And if I think about this idea, you know, for me emotionally, I sometimes wonder too about how much am I thinking so much about the future and what's to come, that deep down I might be, you know, getting tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter before, you know, bang, you've snapped. And I do wonder, as I sort of look around the room at all my instruments, and I sometimes think, you know, which one of you will be the last one standing, and what will you sound like then?
Thank you for listening to this Soundwork, co-produced for the Endgame Story Side by myself, Kyla Brettel, and Rob Law. To find out more about this show, the project, or to listen to more, go to our website, endgamepodcast.net.
Thank you for joining us for Season 2, Episode 1 of Artbreaker. Find all of our episodes by visiting climactic.fm and clicking on Artbreaker. We have some great guests coming up for you, but we'd love your suggestions for great creators we should feature on the show. This Artbreaker format is so flexible and adaptable, and we're so excited about it. We'd love your feedback on what works, what doesn't, or anything you think we should try. We'd love to hear your feedback in your own words, and you can leave us a message from climactic.fm, or send us an email to hello@climactic.fm. On behalf of the whole Artbreaker and Climactic Collective team, thank you for listening. And we'll see you again next time. The Climactic Collective.